welcome to Real Britannia. Today's date is Monday, the 6th of June, 2022, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. It's the start of another week in glorious Blighty. We've had a fantastic weekend of the Queen's Jubilee, and of course, there's not much else to talk about in the news today, but I am, as always, joined by my co-host, Max Musson from Western Spring. Max, good day, sir. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. As you say, we've had a glorious weekend, lots of good weather, and lots of people out celebrating. I think when we have periods of celebration like this, it's not a bad thing because it lifts the spirits of the nation. And I think that all other things aside, all other issues aside, nobody does pomp and circumstance like the British. And so, you know, when it comes to putting on really inspiring displays of pageantry, etc., you know, we are the leaders of the world in that respect. And I think just about every other country in the world you know, looks to us with envy at our ability to do that sort of thing.
It is amazing to see. I was watching some of it on the television. I was just thinking, this is something that's gone on for centuries. You know, they must practice for these jubilees and the various other things with the beef eaters and all the rest of the Queen's Guard, and they must have special clothes for each ceremony that they do, and special rituals that they do with each one of these ceremonies, and it's gone on for centuries and centuries. I mean, some of the things that they use probably don't even come out apart from at a certain time during a king's reign, like when the Queen was coronated, and the special chair that she has, that she sits in, and then you have the jubilee that's going on at the moment, the platinum jubilee. And I wonder if they have different things for different types of jubilee. I remember the silver jubilee more than anything else, which was in 1977. I don't recall the Golden Jubilee very, very, very well, which was 2002. And this is the Platinum Jubilee, which I think is unheard of. I don't think we've ever had a monarch that has ever reigned for so long, Max. Do you know much about the lengths of the monarch's reigns? Do you know much about how long other monarchs have reigned for at all?
Well, prior to Elizabeth II, the longest reigning monarch was Queen Victoria, who reigned from, I think it was 1876 to 1901, which was 63 years. And perhaps it was not quite 60, perhaps it was something different to that. But anyway, it was in the 60s. Since then, though, the monarchs have tended to reign for much shorter periods of time. And one thing that sort of struck me was the fact that you know, people have mentioned in the news that it's unlikely that any other monarch is going to reign for as long as Elizabeth II has, having completed 70 years. And I think that for a long time, that probably is going to be true, because if you look at Prince Charles, for example, Prince Charles is already 73. So even if the Queen was to pass over the baton to him today, for example, he would still have to live to be 143 before he would have reigned for 70 years. And if he decided to pass the baton immediately over to Prince William so that Prince William could become the king today, then Prince William would still have to live to be 109 before he would have reigned for 70 years. And so I think it's a feature of the two women, female monarchs that we have, that they've both, because Victoria was only 18 years old, I think, when she acceded to the throne, and our own Queen Elizabeth II was just 26 when she acceded to the throne, and all of the other kings have been older. And I think that they've just been lucky that they were so young at the point when the crown passed to them, and it's put them in Victoria and now Elizabeth in unique positions in terms of the length of their reign.
It is incredible the age that she's at. She must be nearing 100, and it's almost as if she seems to shrink by the year. I was looking at her on the balcony with Princess Kate, and Kate is like almost twice the size of her. And yet, when you look at pictures of the Queen from the 60s or the 70s, she's not that much smaller than her husband, the Duke of Edinburgh. It's such a shame that he's not here to see the Jubilee through with her. And you're talking about the pomp and the circumstance and everything that they're all wearing. They've also brought this forward into the 21st century as well with technology. Just before the Jubilee celebration started, they were projecting the Queen's face on the stones at Stonehenge, which is really a very original idea. And there were people that were complaining. They were saying, well, this is pagan stuff, and this is the Queen of England, and she's the head of the Church of England. So, well, why are they putting her face on these stones? But those stones are the heritage of Britain. They're British heritage. And we've had a monarchy in this island going back over 2,000 years. I mean, we've talked about the legend of Brutus, the first king of the island here, and some people say that was 6th century BC. Other people say that was the 11th century BC. So 2,000 to 3,000 years we've had monarchs on this island. We've had monarchs on this island when we were pagan. We've had monarchs on this island when we were Christian. And I think she has every right to put her face on those stones. It did look quite incredible to see them there. And there's always this animosity between Christians against pagans in nationalism, and it really doesn't make a lot of sense to me, because it's the same people. The same people were pagan that became Christian. So whatever we had when we were pagan belongs to us still, regardless of whether we're Christian today. It's all a part of our heritage. You know, we can't say, well, we're just going to ignore our pre-Christian past and all the megaliths and all the monuments that we have back then. They belong to us, whether we're Christian or whether we're pagan. They were put there by the indigenous British people thousands of years ago. They're part of our culture. They're part of our heritage. They're something we should be proud of. And I thought it was a good thing to see them, to see her face projected on the stones like that. Was anything that you've picked out at all over the celebrations that you want to draw attention to, Max?
Well, one of the things you just briefly mentioned was the fact that the Queen seems to be very small, it just occurred to me then that I remember reading quite some years ago about the change in people's height as they get older, and on average most people by the time they get to 60-ish will have lost about an inch in height relative to the height that they were in their prime, and then you lose about another inch for every decade that you live beyond age 60. And so the Queen probably is several inches shorter now than she was when she was in her prime. And just as those of us that have reached any sort of age at all will also be shorter than we were when we were in our prime, you know, me included. One of the things that I think, the thing that really impressed me, as I said earlier on, is that nobody does pomp and circumstance and pageantry like we do. It struck me when we had the flypast over Buckingham Palace that other nations try to put on displays of prestige by having nuclear missiles in their transporters going through Red Square and things of that sort, where the Russians are concerned, and big shows of military power like that. But pageantry isn't just all about military power. Pageantry is about culture as well. And you look at the detailed uniforms that various people wear on occasions such as this, that are really elaborate, really beautiful, that really sort of demonstrate the culture that has persisted on these islands for many, many years. The fly past that there was past Buckingham Palace was, again, symbolic of that sort of changing culture stroke scientific advances, because we not only had modern jets flying past, we not only had modern transport aircraft and things of that sort, but we had the Battle of Britain flight come past. And it's I can remember that it isn't so long ago, probably only a decade or two back, that the number of airworthy Spitfires in the world had reduced. I seem to remember that the number of airworthy Spitfires had been reduced to just 2 Spitfires at one point. And I don't think we had any airworthy Lancaster bombers or anything of that sort. But what's happened is that the people that are responsible for the Battle of Britain flight have worked very hard over the years, and there now are a considerably larger number of airworthy Spitfires, and also we've got this Lancaster bomber as well, which creates an element of An element of aesthetic that reflects the time that we have been a great nation, and I think that that's something that's very important to impress upon the on the minds of people.
Well, I do like the traditional side of it as well. I mean, I particularly picked up on the beefeaters and the clothes that they wear. I mean, there's something to be proud of in Britain, really, is the way that we have these traditions. I mean, even when you look at the judges and the wigs that they wear, it's as if they're frozen in time from when the jury system started. And we have these beefeaters wearing their uniforms. They have two different types of uniform. They have a blue and a red one, which isn't their dress uniform. And then they have the red one with the gold and the white, which is, of course, what they're wearing today. And they're supposed to be there to guard prisoners in the Tower. So it goes all the way back to when we had, say, the Welsh princes that were put in the Tower. The uniform comes from the Tudor times, which I think is probably about 300 years ago. And they also look after the ravens. So we have this tradition that if the ravens are ever to fly away from the Tower of London, then great tragedy will befall England. So they mainly look after these ravens today. They clip the wings so they can't fly too far. But they're basically tame ravens that they have there. And they also walk people around the tower there and talk to the tourists. And that's something that goes on all year round. And then you see them at things like this, the ceremony of the Jubilee. You see all the important things that they actually do as part of the Queen's retinue. And I was also wondering why it is that they actually have this name Beefeater. And apparently it's sort of lost in the mist of time. Some people say that it has a French origin, but apparently it's all the Englishmen used to be referred to as Beefeaters. And apparently it's to do with this broth that they used to have that was called Biff or Biffy. But I do like the idea that we're beef eaters. We eat steak rather than, I don't know, being pork eaters or chicken eaters. And I guess in India, where the cow is sacred, you're not supposed to eat cow if you're a Hindu. I mean, it just shows that our culture is so different to the other cultures of the world, where you might not eat pork or you might not eat cows, and yet we're referred to by the fact that we eat beef. And the French, of course, refer to us as roast beef. We refer to them as froggies because they eat the frog's legs and the snails. I think it'd be rather be known for eating steak than frog's legs, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I think if you I did a bit of research some time back when I was thinking about the history of cookery in this country. And if you look back at recipes that are hundreds of years old or menus for grand feasts and things of this sort, that beef and pork and lamb and things of this sort, mutton do feature very, very extensively in those recipes. And that wouldn't have been the food necessarily that everybody would have eaten every day, but it's just that, you know, on feast days, these were the foods that we turned to. Fish also, lots of different types of exotic fish that can be found both in this country and also some fish that are found abroad. Venison also was another thing that featured greatly. All sorts of game birds featured as well. But I think that with cattle being the largest domestic animal that we have and the largest animal that's been raised for its meat, that beef probably was the most common meat that we used to eat. And as you say, the French used to refer to us as le roast beefs, and we used to call them the frogs because of the frog's legs that they eat. There is history in that as well.
You know, I would say that it says that they probably had quite a good standard of living if we were known for eating beef. and the French were known for eating things like frogs and snails. I mean, it costs a fair amount to feed a cow. And I think in India, they used to use them for ploughing and things like that. And it sort of goes back to, why would you want to eat your tractor? You need that to earn money. So it shows that Britain wasn't too badly off. The peasants weren't too badly off if they were referred to as beef eaters. But one thing that did strike me about this is Jubilee, that the origin of the term, it actually goes back to biblical times. And there was an instruction that was given to the Israelites that what they had to do every 50 years, they had to have what's called a Jubilee, and they had to cancel all debt. All debt. I mean, they'll try and tell you today that it wasn't talking about bank debt, but it was. It was all debt. Everything had to go back to zero every 50 years. And if you have that, you don't get into the situation that we get into today, where you have this huge debt mountain that can never be repaid back. It means that people don't lose their family inheritance, because it comes back to them every 50 years. The land comes back to them. And people may say, well, this was something that was given to them in the Old Testament. I mean, why would we be doing that today? That was the Israelites. Well, it was a Christian thing as well. It was Alfred the Great that wrote about it in his laws. I think he actually referred to this at the start of his Dooms, the book of laws that Alfred the Great actually created. So I think back then that they had this jubilee. You were supposed to free all your slaves as well. You were supposed to give back any land that you had bought. All debts were supposed to be zeroed. Of course, you weren't supposed to have usury then either. That was against Christian law, so we didn't have that. And it just meant that we couldn't get into the situation that we get into today. And I do wonder why it is that when the Queen has this jubilee that, she doesn't just cancel all the debt. I mean, that would be a wonderful thing to do. Everything would just go back to zero. The wealth that we had would actually be proper wealth, because you think of all the things that we create in the world. You look around you, that's all we do is create things. And yet, apparently, we have this debt mountain and all the value of everything in the world wouldn't be enough to pay back what we owe in debt. It's a crazy situation that we're in. But that's the actual origin of this word jubilee. If you look it up, you have to look up biblical jubilee. But that's the origin of it. It's a celebration. It was supposed to happen every 50 years. And you're also supposed to not do any work in the fields that year. You're supposed to let the fields go fallow, let the fields have a rest, let everything basically have a rest. And then everything starts again for another 50 years. Just seems a very sensible way to do things. And I do think that was the way that we actually did things in Alfred the Great's time. So that just seems to have been forgotten about. You got any comments on that, Max?
Well, that's something that I've not been aware of previously, but it would tend to establish a kind of a rhythm to life that would be a 50-year rhythm. And I think that people very often, particularly people who are perhaps conservatively minded with a small c, tend to like there to be that kind of rhythm to life. I think that from my perspective, the main criticism that I would have of the monarchy at the moment is the fact that we've gone through a period of weak monarchs, effectively. People praise the Queen for the her sort of steadfast devotion to duty, etc. But the duty that she's been steadfastly devoted to is a duty which is dictated to her by politicians. And I think that during the period when we had a very strong economy, during the period when the degree of nationalism within the population as a whole was much more pronounced than it is today, that we it didn't matter that we had with Victoria a young monarch who was 18 or thereabouts when she acceded to the throne, because there were lots of ministers who were very patriotically motivated around her that would have helped to keep the nation on an upward path. But what we've seen over the course of the last 100 years, of course, is the abdication of Edward VIII, which, in my view, demonstrated that in his particular case, there was a weakness of character there, because, firstly, he was prepared to place his own romantic interests ahead of the national interests of the country, which demonstrates that he had his priorities entirely wrong. And I think that people that have done research into the decline, particularly in the public school system in this country, as well as the state school system, have pointed to the decline in imbuing children with a sense of duty and a sense of striving and helping and giving to the nation. Think not what the nation can do for you, but what you can do for your nation, to use the words of JFK. I think that there was a decline which kind of accelerated with Edward VIII. He was then succeeded by George the Sixth, who was the Queen's father and who was unprepared really to be king, and was a nervous man, and this is why he had the stammer that he had, that he's very famous for. And I think that with him, and then with his daughter acceding to the throne, because he was actually quite an unwell person, and that's why he died quite young. I think he was only about 60 when he died. He died of a lung disease, the Queen took over when she was just 26. And so again, we've had another period where the Queen is then heavily reliant upon ministers. But of course, in the intervening period between Victoria acceding to the throne and Elizabeth acceding to the throne, the quality of the ministers had changed quite significantly. And so now, instead of ministers being primarily motivated by building the power and the prestige and the self-determination and the autonomy of the country, what we've now got is politicians who have become, in terms of their political trajectory, enfeebled by the decline in the educational system that I referred to, so that they're now they measure their success not by building the prestige and the power of the nation, but by the size of the gross domestic product and the numbers and the money. The major contributor to the decline in our world power, or our power as a nation in the world.
I think it's a great shame that the monarchs don't have the power that they used to have. I mean, we have this constitutional monarchy, which basically means that the monarch is not allowed to have anything to do with politics. It's like the power has been taken away from the person that it was invested in with the tradition that we had for thousands of years, and instead the power has been given to the merchants, and it's been given to the businessmen. And it was always the king that was the last recourse for the peasant. When the peasant was being screwed over, basically, by the merchants and by the bankers, then their last recourse was to go to the king, because the king had this absolute power. The monarch had this power, and when it was like that, why would the monarch want to sell parts of the property off? Because the monarch wanted to keep everything to pass it on down to their descendants. I think this is one of the reasons why the monarchy is enfeebled today. And also, I think the very fact that we actually we're guilty of regicide. We killed Charles I when we were supporting Oliver Cromwell. I mean, I don't know how much support there actually was for Oliver Cromwell, but to do something like that is just unheard of. I mean, at the time, Charles I was saying, well, under what authority are you doing this? I am the authority. God has invested the authority in me, and I am here to ensure that Christian law is upheld. Under what law are you executing me? And they didn't have any law. They just executed him, and they put Cromwell in charge. And it seems to me that if that had happened to me, to, you know, one of my ancestors, I wouldn't be best inclined to be doing my best for the people that actually did that. I mean, people complain that the Queen doesn't stand up for the Indigenous British people, but the Indigenous British people didn't stand up for her ancestor, and they had Charles I beheaded. I mean, it's just absolutely unheard of, and it's also gone on throughout Europe. The monarchs were executed. I mean, the most recent one was the Tsar of Russia, And ever since then, we've had this liberal democracy, basically, which means the rule by the oligarchs. And it means that what the oligarchs say becomes the truth. Whoever has the most power determines what the truth is. When before that, we had kings that obeyed Christian law. And whether you're Christian or you're non-Christian, you have to admit that the Christian morals are a very good thing to base the country upon. And up until 100 years ago, they were extremely patriotic. I mean, patriotism was intertwined with Christianity. It was when we came up with the Church of England. I mean, it was a national church, and the monarch is supposed to be the supreme governor of the Church of England, and they're supposed to promote Christian law, and the Queen can't do that because her hands are tied. And who is she being advised by? She's been advised by her ministers. Who are they being advised by? They're being advised by the civil service, and the civil service acknowledges that there are 100 different genders. 20% of your time when you're at the civil service now has to be spent engaged in identity networks, various different gender identities, ethnic minority identities, of course, the identity of the indigenous British people. That's not looked at as an identity anymore. So the Queen's getting her advice from all these political correct apparatchiks. So she's not going to know what the actual truth is. And her hands are tied behind her back. I mean, I know some people will say, oh, the Queen's right at the top. She owns everything. And but I don't think she is. I think she's really just a figurehead. And it's the banks that are controlling everything. So I agree with you, Max. We haven't had any strong characters there as a monarch for about 100 years. I the Duke of Edinburgh, he was good. But he was just the Queen's consort. And when we did the podcast on him, I think we were saying, you know, that was the last of them, really, the last of the alpha males. And when you look at what we have today, I guess we have William and Kate. I think Kate's very good. She surprised us all, really surprised us all. And perhaps William will be good, but I don't hold high hopes for Charles and certainly not for Harry, of course. You got any comments on that?
What I would say is that the thing that the royal family need to focus on, and hopefully they'll be listening into us today, but the thing that they need to focus on is that how popular they are within the nation. And I remember saying this before to people when I've been talking to them about the previous jubilees and with the funeral of the Queen Mother, etc. Immense influence that the royal family still has, even though they've been divested of their power for probably almost a century now, that they still have this immense popularity within the nation, and that popularity translates into political power. But at the moment they don't have the courage to exercise the political power that popularity gives them. And what it really needs is for them to look at their position within the nation and to recognise the fact that it's their responsibility to work towards building the autonomy of our nation, to build the strength and the prestige of our nation, and not to give in to the weasel words of politicians who are only interested in gross domestic product and in greasing the palms of oligarchs and multinational corporations. We need to have a monarch who's going to turn around and effectively and assert his or her will and assert it over the corruption that emanates from Westminster at the moment, and that's what's required. And people say, oh, well, they're only constitutional monarchs, they don't really wield any real power, but popularity is real power. And if the Queen chose an occasion such as this, or if Prince Charles chose an occasion such as this, or William, to announce a change of policy on the part of the royal family, and that they were going to do this, and if they summoned the assistance of the armed forces and all able-bodied men and women in the country to rally to their cause, I think that they would be surprised at the reaction that they get.
Yeah, well,
pleasantly surprised.
Well, we have this system, don't we? We have liberal democracy, progressive democracy. Every 5 years, a new lot are elected in, and they usually last two, maybe three cycles, so 10 years or 15 years. So they're always being replaced, and they're always being put into positions that they don't actually know anything about. No, okay, if you're going to have that system, there are some benefits to it. You've got somebody new all the time, so you've got new ideas. But at the same time, you need to have somebody that's there all the time that also has the same amount of power, and that should be the Queen, that should be the monarch. They should have equal power to the House of Commons or the House of Lords. I think the way the system was set up, the House of Lords was supposed to fulfill that function, and you were supposed to have hereditary peers and people that were born into that, that knew that that is what they were going to be doing, that they would be taught that they needed to put the needs of the nation above the needs of the individual, and they would be taught that they needed to empathize with the working classes and all the rest of it, and they would spend their whole lives knowing that that's what they're going to do, and they're going to be in the House of Lords. Tony Blair upset all of that and made it so that the Lords could be elected by the same sort of democratic principles as the House of Commons, and he could elect his cronies. So we ended up with all these left-wing figures in the House of Lords now, and all these appointees for politically correct reasons, like the mother of Stephen Lawrence. I mean, what is she doing in the House of Lords? Okay, she's lost her son. Terrible thing, terrible tragedy. Trying to do what we can for her, but should she really be there deciding what the policies are of the country? I don't think she should be. I think we should have hereditary peers. But rather than that, we have democracy in the House of Lords, and the power that the monarch should have, which should be equal to what the powers of the democracy has, she doesn't have it. She's just a constitutional monarch. No more can she say, well, I don't agree with feminism. I don't agree with abortion. I don't agree with replacement level migration and demographic replacement. She's not allowed to even announce an opinion on these things, let alone to actually say, well, I don't assent to what you're actually doing. I mean, she has to assent to what the government tells her they're going to be doing. And then she just reads it out, doesn't she? My government is going to do this. My government is going to do that. She's got no say in it whatsoever. And she should have a say in it for the democracy to work.
She has assumed that she's got no say in it, and that's why she's allowing to happen, you know, what has happened to this country over the last seven decades. And the point that I really can't make strongly enough is that the royal family need to just gird their loins, summon up the blood, and just realise just how popular they are in the country, and then to decide to use that popularity to convert that popularity into political power, and to use their power in that respect to put the country back on the right track, and to put us back in a situation where where the government of this country takes the long-term view, where government of this country is government of our people, by our people, where the government of this country is responsible for revigorizing the nation, and by making us cultural and scientific and political leaders within the world, instead of following in the way that we have increasingly started to follow the rest of the world. That's the route to greatness, and what we need is a monarch with the fortitude to be able to assert themselves and assert the rights of our people. Because at the end of the day, you know, irrespective of, you know, whether Charles I was beheaded or whatever, there is an unwritten agreement between or code, depending on what sort of phrase you want to use, between the monarch and the people, that the people obey the monarch, and in return the monarch lavish untold wealth upon the monarch in return for the monarch being beyond bribery and being prepared to give their lives in the service of their people, effectively.
Well, she certainly has enough support, doesn't she? I mean, she should really look at what the ministers have done. I mean, just selling the country out to the EU for a start, handing over sovereignty to this unelected group of bureaucrats from Europe. I mean, okay, we've had Brexit now, we've pulled out of the EU, but just doing that in the first place, I mean, that just shows you that they don't value the people of Britain at all. And if the Queen was to stand up and say, "Well, I'm not having this," then yeah, I agree, Max. I think the public would support her. There is enough support, and that is what the monarch is there for. Well, shall we go back and take a look at times when the monarch did actually have this power, Max? Shall we take a look at our Greatest Britons?
Yes, let's do that.
Okay, we're going to be talking once again about Sir Francis Drake, and we'll begin with a recap. In the last episode, we heard how Sir Francis Drake started life as the son of a Protestant preacher who got a commission to preach to the Navy. Drake became a sailor at a young age, working for a man called John Hawkins, who sought to muscle in on the trade that Spain was involved in. England was not at war with Spain, but covert hostilities were taking place between the two, and when Drake saw the Spanish abandon hundreds of English seamen to their deaths after a battle at sea with them, he decided to become a privateer, a licensed pirate, attacking any Spanish ships that they saw. After capturing tons of treasure from the Spanish gold mines in the New World on a wagon train, Drake climbed up a tree and saw the Pacific Ocean for the first time, and determined to be the first Englishman to navigate it. We also heard how after he took slaves as a booty from the Spanish, he would free them if they could not be sold and give them certificates of freedom to prove that they were a free man. And he took on one of these slaves, Diego, as part of his crew. And yet, despite that, he is still cancelled by the progressives today, despite the good way that he actually treated his slaves. We'll hear more about Diego as we get on with our presentation here. Have you got any comments you want to make on that recap, Max?
Well, it's a surprise. It's surprising when you read the things that you've just been saying about Sir Francis Drake, just how similar his attitude to other people was to the attitude of Cecil Rhodes. Because Cecil Rhodes is somebody who's a woke-arty in this country, are trying to cancel and are trying to pull down his statues and erase him from the history books. And yet Cecil Rhodes dealt with people, and as far as his exploits and adventures in Africa were concerned, you know, he didn't treat the natives as if they were of no account. He made alliances with the various native tribes of Africa and dealt honourably with the leaders of those tribes in order to increase the influence of Britain in Africa at that time. And so that's very, very similar, in fact, to the way in which Sir Francis Drake dealt with non-white people.
Yeah, I don't, he certainly wasn't prejudiced against them. I don't think he was prejudiced against anyone. He wasn't happy with the Spanish because of what the Spanish did, because they just allowed all these English seamen to drown. Well, with the success of the Panama Isthmus raid, that was the raid on the mule train where they got tons of silver and gold. In 1577, Elizabeth I of England sent Drake to start an expedition against the Spanish along the Pacific coast of the Americas. Drake acted on the plan authored by Sir Richard Grenville, who had received a royal patent for it in 1574. Just 1 year later, the patent was rescinded after protests from Philip of Spain. Diego, that's the freed slave, was once again employed under Drake. His fluency in Spanish and English would make him a useful interpreter when Spaniards or Spanish-speaking Portuguese were captured. He was employed as Drake's servant and was paid wages, just like the rest of the crew. Drake and the fleet set out from Plymouth on 15th of November 1577, but bad weather threatened him and his fleet, so they were forced to take refuge in Falmouth, Cornwall, from where they returned to Plymouth for repair. And there's places all over Cornwall that are named after Sir Francis Drake. He's one of their most famous sons. After this major setback, Drake set sail again on the 13th of December aboard the Pelican with four other ships and 164 men. He soon added a sixth ship, the Mary, formerly the Santa Maria, a Portuguese merchant ship that had been captured off the coast of Africa near the Cape Verde Islands. He also added its captain, Nuno da Silva, a man with considerable experience navigating in South American waters. Drake's fleet suffered great attrition. He scuttled both the Christopher and the flyboat the Swan due to loss of men on the Atlantic crossing. He made landfall at the gloomy bay of San Julian in what is now Argentina. Ferdinand Magellan had called here half a century earlier, where he put to death some mutineers, and Drake's men saw weathered and bleached skeletons on the grim Spanish gibbets. Following Magellan's example, Drake tried and executed his own mutineer, Thomas Doughty, on charges of witchcraft, mutiny, and treason. And Drake was, obviously, he was brought up by a preacher. He was a Christian, and he saw that what this Thomas Doughty was doing was anti-Christian witchcraft. So he had him beheaded. The crew discovered that the Mary had rotting timbers, so they burned the ship, and Drake decided to remain for the winter in San Julian before attempting the Strait of Magellan. The three remaining ships of his convoy departed for the Magellan Strait at the southern tip of South America. And a few weeks later, September 1578, Drake made it into the Pacific. But violent storms destroyed one of the three ships, the Marigold, which was captained by John Thomas in the Strait, and caused another, the Elizabeth, which was captained by John Winter, to return to England, leaving only the Pelican. So it started out with four ships, and they're now down to only one. After this passage, the Pelican was pushed south and discovered an island that Drake called Elizabeth Island. Drake, like navigators before him, probably reached a latitude of 55 degrees south, according to astronomical data quoted in Hakluyt's The Principal Navigations, Voyages and Discoveries of the English Nation of 1589, and that was along the Chilean coast. In the Magellan Strait, Francis and his men engaged in a skirmish with local indigenous people, becoming the first Europeans to kill indigenous peoples in southern Patagonia. Well, I mean, it was the local indigenous people that started the fight. Basically, it wouldn't have been Drake that attacked these people. I mean, this is always the case, isn't it? The indigenous or the natives end up fighting against the Europeans, and today we get told, oh, the wicked evil Europeans killed the indigenous peoples, but they were fighting for their lives. It was the same with Captain Cook in New Zealand. During the stay in the Strait, crew members discovered that an infusion made of the bark of Drimmi's wintery could be used as a remedy against scurvy. Captain Winter ordered the collection of great amounts of this bark, hence the scientific name. That's where the wintry bit comes from. So that was extremely useful. Scurvy was a terrible problem that they had on these long voyages. Historian Matineau Martinique, who examined his travels, credits Drake with the discovery of the southern end of the Americas and the oceanic space that is south of it. The first report of his discovery of an open channel south of Tierra del Fuego was written after the 1618 publication of the voyage of Willem Schouten and Jacob Lemery around Cape Horn in 1616. So they say that he was the first Englishman to actually do this, but he actually discovered the southern end of the Americas, and I guess he would have been mapping this as well. So again, he's rather like Christopher... who's that I'm thinking of? The guy that I just mentioned, Captain Cook. So he's rather like Captain Cook. He's not just an adventurer, not just a pirateer, but he's also a map maker and making new discoveries. You got any comments on any of that, Max?
I was just trying to think, actually, what Tierra del Fuego means. Obviously, Tierra means land and del of. Just be interesting to have confirmed what the Fuego means, but I can't quite remember it. My sort of assumption is it might be fire, or it might be sort of storm or something like that, because I'd imagine that the passage round Tierra del Fuego has always been a fairly sort of windy and blustery at best passage, and so sailors would be taking their life in their hands to pass through that. But I think Magellan was the person who found the passage between Tierra del Fuego and the mainland of the South American continent, and who possibly was the first person to get through into one of the earliest people to get through into the Pacific. But as you say, Drake was the first Englishman to do that.
And the first to map that area. And this is the sea that he had seen when he climbed up the tree, although those months back or years back, just after they were trying to escape from the Spanish after burying the treasure. Well, Drake pushed onwards in his lone flagship, which he had now renamed the Golden Hind in honour of Sir Christopher Hatton, and that was after his coat of arms. The Golden Hind sailed north along the Pacific coast of South America, attacking Spanish ports and pillaging towns. Some Spanish ships were captured, and Drake used their more accurate charts. Before reaching the coast of Peru, Drake visited Mocha Island, where he was seriously injured by the hostile Mapuche. Later, he sacked the port of Valparaiso, further north in Chile, where he also captured a ship full of Chilean wine. Near Lima, Drake captured a Spanish ship with 25,000 pesos of Peruvian gold, amounting in value to 37,000 ducats of Spanish money, about £7 million by modern standards. Drake also discovered news of another ship, the Nuestra Señora de la Concepción, which was sailing west towards Manila. It would come to be called the Cacafuego. Drake gave chase and eventually captured the treasure ship, which proved to be his most profitable capture. So he's near the Philippines at this time, if he's near Manila. Mm. Aboard Nuestra Señora de la Concepción, Drake found 36 kilos of gold, a golden crucifix, jewels, 13 chests full of royals of plate, and 26,000 kilos, or 26 long tons, of silver. Drake was naturally pleased at his good luck in capturing the galleon, and he showed it by dining with the captured ship's officers and the gentlemen passengers. He offloaded his captives a short time later and gave each one gifts appropriate to their rank, as well as a letter of safe conduct. So this shows us the way that these privateers operated. They were fighting against Spain. We weren't yet in open hostilities against Spain. But what they would do is that they would take the ships and they would say, we are taking everything that's on here, but they wouldn't harm the passengers. And this is the opposite of what the Spaniards did when they left the English to drown. So they make out that Drake was this terrible pirate, but he wasn't behaving like a pirate. I mean, he was making sure that the people that were on the ship were treated in the way that they were used to being treated. And you got the captured ship's officers here, and he sits down and dines with them, has dinner with them, and gives each one of them gifts, and then they have a letter of safe conduct. It was like when he freed the slaves, they all had a letter saying that they were a free man. It wasn't that they were on the run, and he had the authority to do this from the Queen of England, from Queen Elizabeth I. Any comments on this, Max?
Well, it's just a continuation of the kind of chivalry that existed in medieval times amongst knights, really, isn't it? You know, it's a very chivalrous way for a privateer to behave, and behaving in such a way that he's doing upholding the interests of his nation, but at the same time doing it in a way in which nobody could really condemn him for.
Very chivalrous, yeah. I mean, keeping up English traditions of treating people well and being honourable, basically. Well, prior to Drake's voyage, the western coast of North America had only been partially explored in 1542 by Juan Rodriguez Cabrillo, who sailed for Spain. So, intending to avoid further conflict with Spain, Drake navigated northwest of the Spanish presence and sought a discreet site at which the crew could prepare for their journey back to England. On the 5th of June, 1579, the ship briefly made first landfall at what is now South Cove, Cape Arago, just south of Coos Bay, Oregon, and then sailed south while searching for a suitable harbour to repair his ailing ship. On the 17th of June, Drake and his crew found a protected cove when they landed on the Pacific coast of what is now Northern California. While ashore, he claimed the area for Queen Elizabeth I as Nova Albion, or New Albion. To document and assert his claim, Drake posted an engraved plate of brass to claim sovereignty for Elizabeth and every successive English monarch. After erecting a fort and tents ashore, the crew laboured for several weeks as they prepared for the circumnavigating voyage ahead by careening their ship, Golden Hind, so to effectively clean and repair the hull. Drake had friendly interactions with the Coast Miwok, a Red Indian tribe, and explored the surrounding land by foot. When his ship was ready for the return voyage, Drake and the crew left New Albion on 23rd of July and paused his journey the next day when anchoring his ship at the Farallon Islands, where the crew hunted for seal meat. So we can see here that he had friendly interactions with the Red Indians. So he would be trying to make peace with them at first, but if they fought back, then obviously the English would have to fight back with overwhelming firepower. It wasn't that they were mistreating the natives here at all. And I guess when you're going out and you're discovering new lands, if they don't find evidence of civilization, if they just find that there are some people there that are living in tents that are just moving about, then they're going to claim that for themselves, aren't they? And they're going to see that the resources aren't being used by these peoples. They're not advanced enough to be making use of the resources there. And we need the resources. You know, you're talking of a time when people would have families of 9 or 10 children, and the eldest would be in receipt of whatever the parents had. That would be left to the eldest. But all the rest of them, they would have to go out and do something, and they would have to go out and look for new land. I mean, that's what the Danes were doing when they came to England. That's what the Vikings were doing when they came to England. And the same thing's going on 1,000 years later, when you've got the English going to the New World, searching for new land. And if you look at how populated America is now, that just shows you how this needed to be done. And the strongest force is going to win over the weaker force. And it's not that we mistreated these Indians, as it says here. You know, he had friendly interactions with them. They would make peace treaties with them. They would say, well, can we have this bit of land here? We want to do what we want to do here. You have your bit of land there. And most of the Indians were okay about it, but there were other tribes that would start robbing the English and start robbing the settlers. And that was the origin of the Red Indian Wars. And unlike battles in the past, when the vanquished foe becomes your slave or kills himself, which is what we used to do in the past, rather than accept slavery, you would fall on your sword. And that was the agreement. If you lost the war, you either became a slave or you fell on your sword. Instead of doing that, we gave the Red Indians reservations. And we said, here you are, you can have this land, you can have your own laws, and make your own rules there. And we even honoured them by naming our helicopters and our tanks after these Red Indian tribes. And it just shows you that, you know, the white man is an honourable man. And he's even honourable in battle, or he used to be, up until the last century, and yet we smear these people, and we say that they were terrible racists and white supremacists. I think they were decent people trying to do the right thing. Got any comments on any of this, Max?
Well, just to say that the thing that people always forget when they talk about when they condemn the colonial period was the fact that all of the various tribes of in North America and South America prior to European explorers going there were all fighting each other for their land. You know, it wasn't that they were all living in a sort of blissful kind of paradise and that we arrived and then upset the apple cart and started killing everybody. It's a matter that when explorers landed on these new continents, what they found was that some of the people that they encountered were peaceful people who dealt with them civilly, but that there were other tribes who were the warlike tribes who attacked the Europeans just as readily as they would have attacked other American Indian or Indigenous American tribes, and that you know, very often the fate for the tribes that were beaten in battle was that they would just be slaughtered and genocided. And so the fact that when our explorers went to these places and encountered warlike tribes, the fact that we fought against them and defeated them isn't a sign of our cruelty. It's a sign that of the cruelty that existed before we even went there.
Well, it's a dog-eat-dog world, isn't it? And the point is that we gave these people mercy, and we didn't want to just wipe them out and steal their land from them. We wanted to live in peace alongside them. And where that wasn't possible, we had to show overwhelming force and then give them reservations. And it was the same in all these countries in the New World that we discovered. It was always the hand of peace that was offered to them first. And as we see here, it worked okay with Drake at this point, but in that earlier point, he was attacked. Well, Drake left the Pacific coast, heading southwest to catch the winds that would carry his ship across the Pacific, and a few months later he reached the Moluccas, a group of islands in the Western Pacific in eastern modern-day Indonesia. I mean, he's going right the way around the world here, isn't he? Now he's up near Asia and Malaysia. At this time, Diego died from wounds he had sustained earlier in the voyage, and Drake was saddened at his death as he had become a good friend. So why are they trying to get rid of his statues and his honour today? I mean, this is a slave that he freed that became a good friend that was a good worker on the ship, and yet we're told, oh no, we've got to cancel him completely because he had something to do with a captain that took slaves from the Spaniards and then sold them on in the Americas and freed the ones that he wasn't able to sell. So Drake was, he wasn't prejudiced against these people. If somebody was good at what they did, then he was going to take them on as part of his crew, which he did with Diego. The Golden Hind later became caught on a reef and was almost lost after the sailors waited 3 days for convenient tides and had dumped the cargo. Drake eventually rounded the Cape of Good Hope and reached Sierra Leone by the 22nd of July, 1580. So now they're back in Africa. I hope they didn't dump the gold and the silver. I mean, that must have been an awful situation if they had to dump the gold and silver. I'm sure they must have dropped that off and buried that somewhere on the way so that they could pick it up at another time, I would have thought. Imagine that, you know, the ship's going down and it's full of gold and silver. Half the crew is not going to want to throw that away, are they?
No. I would think that it's almost certain that they would have just offloaded the cargo, buried it somewhere, and then because the ship would then be more buoyant, they would then be able to refloat it and get it off of the reef. And once they'd done that, they would have gone back, dug up the treasure, put it back on the ship and sailed it home.
Yeah, that's the origin of all these buried treasure tales, isn't it? From things like that happening. On the 26th of September, the Golden Hind sailed into Plymouth with Drake and 59 remaining crew on board, along with a rich cargo of spices and captured Spanish treasures. The Queen's half share of the cargo surpassed the rest of the Crown's income for that entire year. Drake was hailed as the first Englishman to circumnavigate the Earth, and the second such voyage, arriving with at least one ship intact after Elcano's in 1520. The Queen declared that all written accounts of Drake's voyages were to become the Queen's secrets of the realm, and Drake and the other participants of his voyages, on the pain of death, sworn to their secrecy. She intended to keep Drake's activities away from the eyes of rival Spain. Drake presented the Queen with a jewel token commemorating the circumnavigation. Taken as a prize off the Pacific coast of Mexico, it was made of enameled gold and bore an African diamond and a ship with an ebony hull. For her part, the Queen gave Drake a jewel with her portrait, an unusual gift to bestow upon a commoner, and one that Drake sported proudly in his 1591 portrait by Marcus Geraerts, now seen at the National Maritime Museum, Greenwich. On one side is a state portrait of Elizabeth by the miniaturist Nicholas Hilliard, on the other a sardonyx cameo of double portrait busts, a regal woman and an African male. The Drake jewel, as it is known today, is a rare documented survivor amongst 16th century jewels. It is conserved at the Victoria and Albert Museum, London. And I should imagine the Africans are probably saying, can we have back the jewel? I mean, they're always doing this now, aren't they? Trying to get back things that we collected many years ago that we have preserved in our museums. And interesting here that the double portrait bust shows a regal woman and an African male. I guess that's basically showing the exotic nature of where it is that Drake has gone, where they have different human beings that look completely different to the ones in England. Queen Elizabeth?
I think that'd be symbolising the regal woman. That would probably be a representation of the Queen, and the inclusion of those two figures would be to demonstrate the Queen having an encounter with Africa, basically, with the African man representing Africa.
Yeah, the queen having the encounter via her subject, her loyal servant, Sir Francis Drake. And again, that, I mean, when he made that plate as well and claimed that land for her in New Albion, and he's naming places after the queen as well. Well, Queen Elizabeth awarded Drake a knighthood aboard the Golden Hind in Deptford on the 4th of April 1581, the dubbing being performed by a French diplomat, Monsieur de Marchemont, who was negotiating for Elizabeth to marry the King of France's brother, Francis, the Duke of Anjou. And listeners will remember we talked about all these attempts to try and get Elizabeth I married, all these diplomatic attempts when we looked at Elizabeth I, and this ties in with one of those. By getting the French diplomat involved in the knighting, Elizabeth was gaining the implicit political support from the French for Drake's actions. During the Victorian era, in a spirit of nationalism, the story was promoted that Elizabeth I had actually done the knighting. After receiving his knighthood, Drake unilaterally adopted the armorials of the ancient Devon family of Drake of Ashe near Musbury, to whom he claimed a distant but unspecified kinship. These arms were argent, a wyvern wings displayed and tail-nailed gules, and the crest, a dexter arm proper, grasping a battle-axe sable headed argent. The head of that family, also a distinguished sailor, Sir Bernard Drake, in 1586, angrily refuted Sir Francis's claimed kinship and his right to bear his family's arms. That dispute led to a box on the ear being given to Sir Francis by Sir Bernard at court, as recorded by John Prince in his Worthies of Devon, first published in 1701. So this is rather strange here. You've got Sir Francis Drake, who has just got England more money more wealth than the Queen has managed to get for herself in an entire year. He's just circumnavigated the globe. And he says, well, I have a distant kinship to this family. And the head of that family refutes the kinship and says, you can't wear my family's arms, and gets him boxed on the ear at court. I mean, that's really bizarre. You would think that they would want to be associated with him. I don't understand.
Perhaps this Bernard fellow had asked Drake for payment in return for being able to display the family's coat of arms, and Drake perhaps had declined and expected the guy to just be happy that Drake was going to associate with his family, and therefore the feud between them grew up.
That's a good point. You know, that could have been something like that. Queen Elizabeth, to assuage matters, awarded Sir Francis his own coat of arms, blazoned as follows: sable, a fess wavy between two pole stars, Arctic and Antarctic, argent, and for his crest, a ship on a globe under ruff, held by a cable with a hand out of the clouds. Over it, this motto, Auxilio Divino. Underneath, sic parvis magna. And in the rigging, whereof is hung up by the heels, a wyvern gules, which was the arms of Sir Bernard Drake. The motto, sic parvis magna, translated literally, is thus great things from small things come. And the hand out of the clouds, labelled Auxilio Divino, means with divine help. The full achievement is depicted in the form of a large coloured plaster over mantle in the Lifetimes Gallery at Buckland Abbey. Nevertheless, Drake continued to quarter his new arms with the wyvern gules, the arms adopted by his nephew Sir Francis Drake, 1st Baronet of Buckland, were the arms of Drake of Ashe, but the wyvern without a node or knotted tail. So he really seemed to want to keep this coat of arms that was actually there from this St. Bernard. And I do like the Queen's sense of humour there, giving him a completely different coat of arms with the wyvern being hung up by the heels in the rigging. And that's great, isn't it? You know, just sort of showing what she thinks of it. And Drake continued to command ships against Spain after war was officially declared, and he went on to attack Spanish colonies before going on to replenish supplies at Sir Walter Raleigh's colony and finally arriving home at Plymouth. to a hero's welcome. And it's after that that we get to the Spanish Armada. So it's probably an opportune moment here to pause. Have you got any comments on all of this today, Max, before we finish?
Well, I think it all just demonstrates what a great character Drake was, and the sort of person who is very rare nowadays, but I suspect was probably more commonly found in times gone by, as this series of Great Britons tends to demonstrate. And it's impossible to think that he could be anything other than a very likeable and impressive character, basically.
He's a fantastic example of an Englishman, isn't he, when you think about it?
Absolutely.
And I do like this example we have here of Queen Elizabeth's humour as well. Well, thank you very much for coming on today then, Max.
That's been really enjoyable. Thank you.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next Monday with more Real Britannia for you. And, of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.